Nuclear funeral. That's what citizen activists held as they faced the death of their long-fought battle to force a comprehensive cleanup of their radioactive site adjacent to their homes, only 30 miles from downtown Los Angeles. But it seems that truth doesn't seem to make much impact when spoken to power, nuclear power, no matter how long, hard, and loudly you speak it, how many experts you use to back it up, and above all else, the fact that it's the right thing to do to protect the lives of people, especially children, and the environment. What's at stake? How bad is it? It takes a concerned parent activist, someone who has been fighting on the front lines for a meaningful cleanup from the start, to tell us
some parts of the property owned by Department of Energy. We've been told by our technical expert that some areas are so hot, it would be the same as getting an x-ray if you were to walk through there. And with the intention of turning this into a public park, you know, I seriously doubt there are going to be warning signs, do not hike here if you're pregnant.
Or, it seems, any other kind of warning signs. Well, when Melissa Bumstead, founder and co-director of Parents Against the Santa Susana Field Lab, explains the dangers at SSFL and the heartbreaking diminishing of a former agreement to clean it up that favors the polluters over parents and children and the environment, you see how deeply the nuclear industry keeps us stuck in that awful, deadly, dangerous seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaking. Nuclear hot seat, it's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. We're a show for people who know nothing about nuclear who want to know something, and people who know something about nuclear who would like to know just a little bit more. My name is Libby Halevi. I'm the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, we talk with the co-directors of Parents Against the Santa Susana Field Lab, founder Melissa Bumstead and Jenny Mack. They fill us in on the problems at the site, the impact on community health, promises made that are now being broken by Boeing, the Department of Energy, and NASA, and what the consequences may be. It's a round robin of corporate and governmental manipulation, languaging trickery, broken promises, and the outrage of parents trying to protect their children from cancer and other illnesses. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, numbnuts of the week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, Linda Pence Gunter with the Nuclear Hot Seat Hot Story, Jack Cohen Joppa of the Nuke Resistor with another story from our shared history of successful activist resistance, and more honest nuclear information than you can get from the U.S. government under any circumstances, let alone during the current shutdown. All of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, October 7, 2025, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Starting out this week with Ukraine, where high tensions continue at the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant, still in long-term outage as of the recording of this episode. Linda Pence Gunter reports with this week's very hot, hot story.
It's deja vu all over again, but not in a good way. For the 10th time since the Russian military took over, the 6-reactor Zaporizhia nuclear power plant in war-torn Ukraine is without off-site power. As I record this, the plant has been without off-site power for 2 weeks. By the time you hear this, maybe good sense will have prevailed, the power line will be fixed, and the two sides in the war in Ukraine will have realized that detonating explosives close to nuclear power plants is not a good idea. When off-site power was lost to the nuclear site on September 23rd, workers there had to turn to backup diesel generators. It's a drill they're familiar with, except that this time the outage has endured longer than a few days, as in the past. But diesel generators don't last indefinitely. One has already failed. Eventually, they will need fresh fuel. The Russian forces who have occupied the plant since March 4, 2022, assure us that everything is under complete control. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, in contrast, has called the situation at the plant critical and that, quote, no terrorist in the world has ever dared to do to a nuclear plant what Russia is doing right now. We have been here before, 9 times. External power provided by the grid has been lost, backup diesel generators have been called into duty, and Ukraine and the rest of the world has held its collective breath, hoping we're not about to witness another major nuclear disaster. Zaporizhzhia is not the only nuclear power plant at risk in Ukraine. There are 3 others, totaling 15 reactors at all 4 sites. In late September, a drone detonated just 875 yards from the perimeter of the South Ukraine 3-reactor nuclear power plant. Monitors from the International Atomic Energy Agency said they observed at least 22 drones close to the facility. Once again, drones are flying far too close to nuclear power plants, putting nuclear safety at risk, wrote the IAEA's Director General Rafael Grossi in a September 25th statement after the drone incident. Fortunately, last night's power incident did not result in any damage to the South Ukraine nuclear power plant itself. Next time, we may not be so lucky, he wrote. Ah yes, luck. At least he admits that that is the flimsy basis on which the agency is relying in order to avoid another nuclear catastrophe. Meanwhile, the IAEA continues ardently to promote the use and expansion of nuclear power around the world. Currently, all 6 reactors at Zaporizhzhia are in cold shutdown, which means less cooling is needed for the hot fuel still in the reactors, but they are by no means out of danger, and nor are the fuel pools that house at least 855 tons of highly radioactive waste fuel. It is also unclear how many members of the trained Ukrainian plant staff remain to operate the facility. According to an alarming new investigative report, Seizing Power, prepared by Truthhounds and supported by Greenpeace Ukraine, numerous personnel have been abducted from the plant, interned, and even tortured. Accessing cooling water has also become more of a challenge. The Khachovka Dam was destroyed in June 2023, leading to the depletion of the Khachovka Reservoir, the vital water source for the Zaporizhzhia plant. That has left operators drilling for groundwater wells on site in order to keep cooling water flowing into the reactors and the pools. According to estimates, there are 2,000 tons of radioactive waste stored on the Zaporizhzhia site, which, if released through fires or explosions, would have a devastating impact on the health of those downwind, as well as the environment and Ukraine's economy, which is heavily dependent on agricultural exports, mainly grains. That the war in Ukraine, and others elsewhere, must end is stating the obvious. Human suffering around the world is already too great and entirely avoidable. Wars involving nuclear power plants ramp up the risks monumentally. But those dangers are also ever present, given nuclear power is inherently dangerous both on good days and bad. A nuclear accident could happen any time and anywhere there are nuclear reactors. The IAEA may count on luck. The rest of us shouldn't accept that. I'm Linda Pence-Gunter with Beyond Nuclear, reporting for Nuclear Hot Seat. And that's this week's hot story.
As of Tuesday, October 7, there were stories published about the return of power to Zaporizhzhia. But it was not talking about the nuclear reactors. It was talking about the region, which went through a blackout after some drone attacks. Their power has been restored, but not to the backup power systems at the Zaporizhzhia 6 nuclear reactor site. It has now been 2 weeks, which makes it the longest blackout of backup power at a nuclear reactor ever. And without restoration of backup power or a serious refueling of the backup generators, which are not built to run this long, we could be facing something catastrophic. And on October 1st, A drone knocked out power for more than 3 hours to the site of the 1986 Chernobyl nuclear disaster. According to an announcement by Ukrainian President Zelensky, Russia launched over 20 Shahed drones against energy infrastructure in Slavutich, the city whose power supply services Chernobyl. This wave of drones overwhelmed defenses and caused a blackout, affecting the sarcophagus that prevents radioactive dust from escaping the destroyed fourth reactor at Chernobyl and the storage housing more than 3,000 tons of spent fuel. Like the reactors at Zaporizhia, the Chernobyl site requires a constant power supply to run crucial cooling systems for spent fuel rods in order to avoid a potential nuclear incident. A blackout could also blind the radiation monitoring systems installed to boost security at Chernobyl and operated by the UN's International Atomic Energy Agency. In his address, Zelensky said, "Russia is deliberately creating the threat of radiation incidents. Every day of Russia's war, every strike on our energy facilities, including those connected to nuclear safety, is a global threat. Weak and half measures will not work. Strong action is needed." The power has since been restored to Chernobyl. In other international news, here's
Nuclear Hot Seat. Nuclear Hot Seat. Nuclear Hot Seat. None that's out of week.
The Swedish government has appointed a special investigator to propose how compensation from the state should be paid if nuclear power is phased out due to future political decisions. It says the possibility for compensation should provide predictability to owners, reduce risk for investors, and thereby enable more investments in nuclear power. In other words, they want to set it up so that if you're an owner or an investor in nuclear, you can't lose. This is a fail-safe, get-out-of-jail-free card. They're about to decide who should be eligible for compensation, the type of political decisions for which there should be a right to compensation to the nukesters. They want to analyze the extent to which compensation should be paid for investments that have begun in new nuclear power reactors that have been canceled due to political decisions before the reactor has been put into operation, which right now, if you're talking about small modular nuclear reactors, it's all of them. They want to propose a model for calculating compensation, submit proposals on how the compensation should be financed, and necessary legislative proposals or other proposals for regulation. Man, they've got this thing tricked out 12 ways to Sunday. Minister of Energy and Enterprise Ebba Busch said, "As an owner of a nuclear power plant, you should not have to worry that politics will pull the rug out from under new nuclear power. A new right to compensation can increase security for owners and lead to more investments in Swedish nuclear power. That, of course, will reimburse if anything goes south on the country deciding at some future time that maybe nuclear is not such a good idea." Man, who got paid what and who's in whose pocket? This is even worse than the Price-Anderson Act here in the United States. So to the nuclear and political brainiacs behind this particular scheme to once again indemnify the nuclear industry from taking any responsibility from any mistakes that they might make, you are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, none that's out of week.
We'll be posting links to two articles that I believe you will find of interest. Linda Pence Gunter has an article in BeyondNuclearInternational.org, "The Golden Age of Nuclear is All Veneer." And she starts, "Once again, working people, this time in Britain, have been betrayed with false promises about jobs in an industry that is actually making climate change worse." Linda is always worth the read. And, "As nuclear tensions reach new heights, how can we win global disarmament?" Subtitled, "Nuclear Deterrence is Untenable. We Need to Pursue Anti-Colonial Disarmament." It's written by Derek Seidman, and it's based on a panel he put together for Truthout with three organizers and scholars from around the world who are working to advance nuclear abolition. Sarah Hagdusti, the Iranian-American Executive Director of Win Without War. Leila Hanaoui, an Associate Professor of International Law at Hasiba Ben Bouali University in Chlef in Algeria, who has written about the Global South and nuclear colonialism. and Achin Vanayak, a member of the Coalition for Nuclear Disarmament and Peace in India. We'll link to an edited version of this interview on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 746. In New York, 45,000 gallons of radioactive water from the now-shut-down Indian Point nuclear power plant have been approved to be dumped into the Hudson River. This after a federal court struck down a state environmental law. U.S. District Judge Kenneth Karras sided with the company Holtec International over New York State in a ruling issued last week that reversed the 2023 Save the Hudson Law, which sought to prevent the company from contaminating the Hudson's waters with radioactive water. Holtec sued last year on the basis that, they said, only the federal government has a right to regulate discharge of Indian Point's nuclear waste. What's really infuriating is that the story in the New York Post that I'm getting this information from referred to this as 45,000 gallons of, quote, mildly radioactive, unquote, water that would be dumped into the Hudson. Mildly radioactive is the same as saying just a little bit pregnant. Even more outrageous, Governor Kathy Hochul, who celebrated the signing of the Save the Hudson law just 2 years ago, slammed the closure of Indian Point as short-sighted while announcing plans for a new nuclear facility, citing nuclear as being the source of, quote, almost all clean energy. No mention was made of the potential for genuine renewables, such as solar, wind, tidal, better conservation, and the need to preserve and protect the health of all those who are in proximity with the facility, which, let's face it, with nuclear, that's all of us. Now comes word that Holtec is toying with the idea of reopening Indian Point to meet surging power demands. And Patrick O'Brien, director for government affairs at Holtec, said, "It will just take time and money and political will." To which Nuclear Hot Seat says, "Follow that money." In St. Louis County, health officials have released new data on the health risks metro residents face if living near radioactive waste in Coldwater Creek that's been left over from atomic bomb production decades ago during the Manhattan Project. The St. Louis County Department of Public Health has issued a health alert to raise awareness about the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act to help those who have been exposed to governmental radioactive waste and are eligible for financial compensation. The department said people living in RECA, that's short for Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, RECA-impacted zip codes are 44% more likely to get lung cancer, 40% more likely to get kidney cancer, and 18% more likely to get cancer overall. The zip codes referenced are 63102 and 63147, an area that includes much of North St. Louis County, as well as portions of North City and St. Charles County. The health advisory also suggests that if you or a family member has gotten cancer, check to see if you qualify for compensation. We'll put a link up to where you can do that. In Navajo Nation, which extends over parts of Arizona, New Mexico, and Utah, Navajo communities want the rationale of burying low-level radioactive waste in solid waste landfill delivered in language that all can understand, including Navajo elders who do not understand English as a first language. Under the discussion is the removal of 1.1 million cubic yards of radioactive rock and sand from within the Redwater Pond Road community and cleanup of the former Kivira uranium mine near Church Rock. The proposed removal plan means that an estimated 76,710 truckloads, over 60 truckloads a day, will have to travel a 44-mile haul route along New Mexico Highway 566 to Interstate 40E, across the Continental Divide to and through downtown Thoreau to the Red Rock landfill. That's an awful lot of trucks carrying an awful lot of radioactive waste an awful long distance to expect that nothing will go wrong. And this program is a test pilot for waste removal that, if it's successful, the state of New Mexico could approve the disposal of more radioactive waste in other areas of the landfill on a case-by-case basis. Before they get there, however, the people want it communicated to all of their people in language they can understand. The White House is preparing to give away 20 metric tons of weapons-usable plutonium to new Nuclear START companies. That's the equivalent of 2,000 nuclear bombs previously slated for permanent disposal as nuclear waste from the nation's Cold War era. The fledgling nuclear companies would use the plutonium fuel in still unproven, unlicensed, and not even built new generation nuclear power plants for domestic power production. But it also expands the threat of nuclear proliferation. We have an article on this, and we'll link to it. And we have a roundup article on Fukushima recovery problems and other issues in Japan. We'll post that at nuclearhotseat.com under this episode, number 745. But to get you started, China has conditionally resumed the importation of Japanese seafood products as of June 30th, except for seafood from the 10 prefectures closest to the Fukushima disaster site. Beijing had banned all such imports from Japan as a protest and precaution following the 2023 start of deliberately discharging large volumes of radioactively contaminated cooling water into the Pacific Ocean. The 2023 ban was imposed to, quote, comprehensively prevent the food safety risks of radioactive contamination caused by the discharge of nuclear wastewater from Fukushima into the sea, end quote. This according to China's General Administration of Customs. Shocked by Japan's action, Beijing's foreign ministry added that the discharge was an, quote, extremely selfish and irresponsible act, which would, again, quote, push the risks onto the whole world and pass on the pain to future generations of human beings. Chinese customs officials said the seafood import ban would continue for 10 prefectures, namely Fukushima and its 9 closest neighboring states, Gunma, Tochigi, Ibaraki, Miyagi, Niigata, Nagano, Saitama, Tokyo, and Chiba. Products from other regions will need health certificates, radioactive substance detection qualification certificates, and production area certificates issued by the Japanese government for Chinese customs declarations. In a related item, Hong Kong announced that it will maintain its ban on Japanese seafood, sea salt, and seaweed imports from the same 10 prefectures, citing ongoing concerns about the risks associated with the discharge of radioactive wastewater. But the major point is that countless dilemmas and setbacks have plagued the now 14-year-long emergency response to the triple reactor meltdown and widespread radiation releases that began at Fukushima on Japan's northeast coast on March 11, 2011. In 14 years' time, engineers have managed to design, build, test, and rebuild a one-of-a-kind robot that removed less than 1 gram of the waste fuel from reactor number 2 last year. That November, quote-unquote, breakthrough was 3 years behind schedule, and some experts estimate that the decommissioning work could take more than a century. Of an estimated 880 tons of debris, with only less than 1 gram having been recovered to date, and 1 million grams in a ton, TEPCO has only 879 million plus grams to go. And as the Asahi Shimbun newspaper smirked, a simple calculation based on the time since the accident suggests the removal process could take another 13.6 billion years to complete. The torturously slow process has made TEPCO's early prediction of complete cleanup by 2051, 40 years' time, appear to have been made for PR reasons. Ya think? We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment, but first, traveling to cover nuclear events is an important part of my work with Nuclear Hot Seat. Earlier this year, thanks to the generosity of Nuclear Hot Seat listeners, I was in New York to cover the third meeting of states parties on the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons at the United Nations. I've just returned from the internationally acclaimed Westheimer Peace Symposium, held under the auspices of the Wilmington College Peace Resource Center in Ohio, and you'll learn all about this remarkable event for next week's special program. Now, there's one final trip for 2025 on the horizon, to the International Uranium Film Festival, being held November 13 and 14 in Window Rock, Navajo Nation, New Mexico. It's an ingathering of filmmakers, films, and activists from around the world. I've attended the three previous IUFF sessions in Navajo Nation and intend to be there again this year to not only view the films, but to network with those who oppose nuclear and gain insights into their issues for future episodes. Being on site helps extend the reach of any event I cover to where it is not just shared on the show, but held in archive for future research. Here's the challenge. I need to raise the money to cover my expenses, travel, ground transportation, housing, and meals. This is over and above the monthly costs of running Nuclear Hot Seat, and the only possible source of the necessary funds is you. So I'm asking for your help. If you can help me get there to cover the events for Nuclear Hot Seat, please consider making a donation. Go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the red donate button. You can earmark it for IUFF or Film Festival. Nuclear Hot Seat is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which means that your donation is tax deductible. We make it easy. Go to nuclearhotseat.com, click on the red donate button, or send directly via Zelle to info@nuclearhotseat.com. No amount is too small, no amount is too large, so don't wait. Go to nuclearhotseat.com to donate now. And whatever you can do to help, I am deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now here's this week's featured interview. Here in California, parents and residents staged a symbolic funeral to protest the threatened death of a promised cleanup at the Santa Susana Field Lab, or SSFL. This is one of California's most contaminated sites. The event took place on Tuesday, October 7, ahead of a public meeting hosted by the Department of Toxic Substance Controls, a state department that oversees the supposed cleanup. The demonstration began outside Boeing's Van Nuys facility, where mourners laid a funeral wreath beside a hearse to represent what's at stake if cleanup promises are abandoned. A procession then traveled to Simi Valley, where the field lab is located, and where dozens of residents and cleanup reporters held a candlelight vigil with oversized tombstones, a coffin, and the aforementioned hearse. Following the vigil, participants joined a live telecast of DTSC's online hearing. It was called to address Boeing's newly released Corrective Measures Study, or CMS, for soil cleanup at the field lab, a plan that experts say marks a dangerous retreat from longstanding commitments to fully clean the site. To learn more about the history at Santa Susana Field Lab, again, it's only 30 miles from downtown Los Angeles, and the event, I spoke to Melissa Bumstead, founder and co-director of the group, and her co-director, Jenny Mack. Note that this interview took place on October 3rd, before the funeral was held. I'm honored to have with us both co-directors of Parents Against Santa Susana Field Lab, the founder and co-director, Melissa Bumstead.
Hi there. Thank you for having us.
And Jenny Mack, who is also co-director.
Hi.
For those who might not be familiar with us, tell us, what is the Santa Susana Field Lab and what is the situation there?
The Santa Susana Field Lab is one of California's most toxic and radioactive Superfund sites in the hills just above Los Angeles. It is owned by the Boeing Company, NASA, and the Department of Energy. Cleanup agreements were signed back in 2007 and some others in 2010, and the whole site was supposed to be cleaned up by 2017. My daughter is a two-time cancer survivor. That's how I got involved in all of this. And I believe that if they had cleaned up the site when they had promised they would, entirely possible my daughter would have never had cancer. Jenny and I run a community group that is fighting tooth and nail, not only against these polluters and responsible parties, but also against the Department of Toxic Substances Control, which is the California regulating agency that was supposed to have enforced this cleanup. And we are finding with such powerful agencies and the Boeing company, we're not making any progress at all, actually. We are in a dire strait right now for the cleanup of the site.
Let's explore this because it's complex, with the three entities you mentioned being responsible for cleanup, Boeing, NASA, and DOE, and also California having to weigh in through the Department of Toxic Substance Control. How are they related to each other in terms of their responsibility?
It's tricky because I think that the responsible parties use their statuses as either private or federal or the state being a state regulatory agency against or as a mechanism to avoid and evade cleanup responsibilities at the site. So we do have NASA and the Department of Energy. And if you talk to a state senator, they might say, hey, this is a federal issue. We need to talk to your federal reps. And if we do that, they're like, well, DTSC is a state regulator. They're the ones responsible for enforcing this cleanup at the state level. Go back down to the state level and advocate with your electeds at that level. We have a really tricky time because we have entities at both the federal and state level.
And the type of contamination is also different depending on which responsible party you're talking to. So the Boeing company is primarily responsible for the part of the site that was used for rocket engine testing and chemicals testing and liquid metal testing. And so their portion of the site is extensively contaminated with toxins. However, the Department of Energy is where they hosted up to 10 nuclear reactors. Four of those had significant accidents, and one of those was actually potentially one of the worst nuclear meltdowns in American history. That we call it the SRE meltdown. And so Department of Energy is responsible for mostly the radionuclide cleanup.
When did that major meltdown, that major accident happen?
The major accident itself was in 1959 and was followed by decades of poor material handling, open air burn pits, other accidents, leaks, spills, fires in the hot lab. And because of that, the contamination, both radioactive and toxic, they're loose in the soil and in the groundwater, which for community members like me and Jenny, that puts us at high risk because it's very mobile and it's able to migrate into the community.
What plans have been made or are seemingly in place for the cleanup of the radioactive contamination, and how far have they come?
Let me walk you back a second to 2007, when all three responsible parties signed a cleanup agreement that they would completely clean up the site to be safe enough that hypothetically a resident could live on site, grow food there, eat it, and not get cancer from it. That was a promise made to the community. That was one of several options for this cleanup agreement. Obviously, there were ton of loopholes. And because of that, a new cleanup agreement was drafted in 2010. And it was much stricter that not only would it be safe for residents, it would bypass a lot of the loopholes. And if something was radioactive, it would be removed. If it was man-made, it would be removed. And we call that a background cleanup. And as far as I know, I don't know of any other cleanups to that strict of a level. It's really kind of remarkable and a standard that would protect us. Unfortunately, Department of Energy has been working hard to undo those cleanup agreements. They've gone as far as last December in 2024. They issued a notice of intent pretty much to redo that cleanup agreement. And they had a lot of reasons why, but one of them is they claim that Boeing entered into a settlement agreement with the state that is going to allow Boeing to leave 90% of their contamination on site, walk away, turn it into a public park, and call it safe. And the Department of Energy actually wrote in their notice of intent that according to Boeing's settlement agreement, the cleanup would be to including a resident with garden scenario, which actually Boeing butchered. And so they're saying that they would like to consider the same framework from Boeing's settlement agreement. So instead of it being a science-driven, sampling-driven cleanup, it would be a risk-based cleanup. And that's where these polluters get away with so much.
So, in other words, they're trying to use the example put forth by Boeing as the example to be used for any cleanup. I mean, we can put that in quotes at this point by NASA and DOE. In other words, if one gets away with it, the others are going to fall in line and get away with it as well. So these are really issues that are enmeshed with each other.
I'd like to add to what Melissa mentioned. One of the issues that someone who is unfamiliar with our site may not catch is the state DTSC is proposing a residential cleanup with garden, which you would think would mean what it sounds like. Okay, it would be stringent enough to be able to live on site and eat the food grown on site. But what they did in the 2022 settlement agreement was they changed the RBSOLs or the risk-based screening levels upon which that standard is based. So the state revised the cleanup standards, keeping the labels the same. So when they write in their current decision documents that they are going to do a residential with garden cleanup standard, if you don't look at the side by side of the risk-based screening level standards, you would think, oh, that's great, we won. They're upholding their, at least Boeing was upholding the part of their agreement. And DTSC is not presenting that. They're not doing the side by side, nor do they want to be pulled into discussion about it. But the truth of the matter is that Boeing, in the settlement agreement, was able to weaken those risk-based screening levels. And so the residential with garden standard now more closely resembles the recreator standard, which is not safe enough to live on site and eat the vegetables. That recreator standard previously was based on only being there a few hours at a time, a couple times a year. So we're into tricky business where they're saying that we're getting something that they have changed the definition of, and that is a loss for our community.
They cooked the books. I mean, really, that's what they did. They went behind closed doors, they moved around all the numbers, and they came out saying, oh, you're getting what you really want. But we had independent experts from Committee to Bridge the Gap who really went through it with a fine-tooth comb, and they were able to show that no, it actually will allow 90% or more of the contamination to remain in place while calling it cleaned up, which is why we are throwing a funeral for our cleanup.
That's what I wanted to get to next because I live approximately 30 miles away from Santa Susana Field Lab, which doesn't exactly put me in the middle of it, but I'm certainly aware that it's there and that when the winds blow, when the fire swept through a few years ago and the smoke was re-aerosolizing the radionuclides from the site so that they were being spread by the smoke, when I could smell the smoke, I knew that the potential was there for me to be inhaling radiation, radionuclides, things that could definitely harm my health. So, with me being this close, my attention was caught by this new demonstration that you are putting together, which is one of many creative steps that your group has taken to illustrate in an unavoidable way exactly what we're up against. Explain to us what this demonstration is going to be and what it consists of.
We're at the point where Boeing is submitting some of their final documents to where shovels are going to be in the dirt soon, and they're going to call it a cleanup, not clean it up, and then walk away forever. And in our minds, we have, I mean, for gosh, I've been doing this for 10 years now, and we have tried all the avenues. We've tried petitions, we've tried protests, we've tried legislation, we've tried working with elected officials, we've tried lawsuits, and it has been very, very frustrating that we are no further. In fact, we're worse off than we were 10 years ago with the commitments from these polluters and also from the accountability from the government agency. So we have realized that, you know, unless something really changes, our cleanup is dead. And because we always like to insert humor in as much as possible, we rented a hearse and we rented a coffin. I didn't even know you could rent a coffin until just a few days ago. So we're going to be dressed in black, all of our supporters. I'm making giant oversized tombstones in my backyard right now that say death of the residential with garden cleanup scenario. We're hoping, we recognize that this is a PR stunt, but we're at that level where we need national attention, maybe even international attention on what is happening here, because Boeing has so much influence. We are running out of ideas on how to counter it.
The decision documents being released, which the state acknowledges these are decision documents, unless they are overturned or a miracle would happen within the agency, within DTSC, where they would decide for some reason to rescind the settlement agreement. We did lose a comprehensive health protective cleanup to background. In the settlement agreement, it was stated that Boeing was also going to clean up their RADs to background. That is not what these decision documents, it's not what this, how the statement of basis reads. And our fear is that even though Boeing didn't sign the 2010 agreement to remediate to background, our fear is that whatever they're doing, which is not to background with chemicals or RADs, DOE and NASA are going to do their darndest to emulate and adopt what Boeing does. And we don't see any sign from the state of keeping that from happening. We do not see any posturing from the state that they intend to enforce the background cleanup for NASA and DOE. So it looks like what Boeing is rolling out is very likely to be adopted from NASA and DOE, who did agree to do a background cleanup. And that's where we're really in trouble because that's where the majority of the radiation contamination lies.
Some parts of the property owned by Department of Energy, we've been told by our technical expert that some areas are so hot, it would be the same as getting an X-ray if you were to walk through there. And with the intention of turning this into a public park, I seriously doubt there are going to be warning signs, do not hike here if you're pregnant. The lack of responsibility of all the parties involved with this to not protect human health and the water and the wildlife. It's shocking. It is truly shocking.
One of the tricks that they always use is turning it into either a public park or a wildlife refuge. Because let's face it, wildlife doesn't vote. They don't have a voice in this. And if it's a public park, it's just people traipsing through and rock climbing, because I know that's a rock climbing area, not knowing what they are being exposed to there in the dust that might be kicked up, in whatever might be in the soil that they are walking over. And beyond that, there's the difficulty that anything that happens in California is usually at the cutting edge of whatever's going to be happening elsewhere. So that the decisions made here and the manipulations made here create a template for other places where they're up against the same issues and they go, oh, goody, let's go from point A to point Z on what they did in California and we can get away with the same stuff too.
The Santa Susana Field Lab is such a small site in the Department of Energy's mind that 10 years ago when we started this, we weren't part of the 10-year plan that they put out every year. We weren't on the map in the Department of Energy Federal Building in Washington, D.C. Literally, we were not there. I think because we are a very vocal group, we are now included in both of those. But it's interesting to me that for such a small site, in Department of Energy's mind, how hard they're fighting not to do a cleanup. And I think you're exactly right, Libby. I think that they know that we have one of the most probably historic cleanup agreements that would protect people nearby because they would actually have to remove all man-made radiation. They know if we get this cleanup, they might have to use that with all of their other sites. Imagine that. People being safe everywhere. And of course, that costs more money to do a better cleanup. To have to make sure not only is all the radiation removed, but that it's also taken to the proper waste facility in order to make sure other people aren't harmed. And that's more expensive. So I think, in a way, we are a big threat, even though we are a very small site. But that is also why we take this fight so seriously, is realizing that it could help set a new standard and maybe help other residents living near a Department of Energy and other toxic and radioactive sites.
Is the potential there for the dramatic, slightly comedic, but in the long run, not really demonstration you're doing on Tuesday with the hearse With the rented coffin, I don't know why someone would rent a coffin and then return it and what they'd have to do to it. But be that as it may, is there a realistic chance that if this gets the kind of attention that it deserves, that it can forestall any kind of ultimate decision, or perhaps ding the direction it's going in, or perhaps change it? Is that a realistic, fingers crossed expectation?
I mean, this really is kind of a Hail Mary situation, but I believe in miracles. I really do. And I think, I'm hoping that maybe the next governor of California will see this and realize, well, someone's going to have to take charge here. Maybe it'll be me. Maybe they'll make it happen. But it is going to take some real intentional force from a person with a lot of power to get things turned around. And Jenny and I have decided whether we win or lose, we're going to keep fighting. We're not going to give up. The community's not going to give up because we all live here. But the direction of the cleanup, it's so critical. And I don't know that we will be able to change it ourselves.
I think that it would take decision makers with incredible integrity and vision, an alliance to doing what is right for future generations, in spite of how politically unpopular it would be to turn against the powers of someone like Boeing. I understand when I watch our electeds struggle to champion this because it's a huge, formidable opponent. Having to fight against Boeing, DOE, and NASA is too big for any single elected official. If a governor decided to completely right the ship and change environmental policy, not just our site, it would need to be someone who wanted to change it across the state with a vision of influencing it across the country, setting precedents, looking towards the future. And the future of humanity. It would take someone with incredible vision. Are we going to get that? I don't know, but I think that that is what it would take. And when Melissa says that we're in it for the long haul, I think, unfortunately, I'm not as optimistic as Melissa is. I've resigned to understanding that we may, as people who live beneath the site, have to be relying on community science, having more air monitors that are run by us or other independent entities that are looking for the things that would impact our health. We may not be able to get the site clean, but we have to find multiple ways to protect ourselves from, the windy seasons that we get out here, both in the spring and in the fall. We have times of the year where we are more at risk to being impacted from migrating debris. And, I can't tell you how disappointing it was to look at the CMS, this corrective soil measures document, yesterday, to look at page 114 and to see that DTSC says that there's no potential for off-site migration.
And we know that it has happened because of the citizen science that took place after the big fire here. What was it, about 5 years ago, 6 years ago?
Right. So to see that they are still, making that erroneous claim, I think that they think that's somehow going to protect them by just, blanket denial. In writing, we know that that is false. And we know that our advocacy will continue to be needed to help make people aware of potential impacts. I fear that that is where the majority of our work may ultimately lie for the future. If we do not get a champion, and it would take someone with incredibly broad shoulders and incredible dignity and integrity.
We will, of course, stay in touch with you here from Nuclear Hot Seat. My condolences to whatever dies or has died as a result of the funeral, but I'm hoping for a resurrection. Perhaps there's still life in the old girl and the old guy yet, and we can move on to a better resolution. For now, Melissa Bumstead and Jenny Knack, I want to thank you for having been my guest today on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Nice meeting you.
That was Melissa Bumstead and Jenny Knack, co-directors of Parents Against the Santa Susana Field Lab. We will have pictures up from the funeral on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 745. And now, let's give the Nuclear Resistor Report the honor that it deserves. Now here with another story of heroism in the fight against nuclear weapons is Jack Cohen-Joppa of the Nuclear Resister.
The Nuclear Resister Archives of Nonviolent Action at the Nevada Nuclear Weapons Test Site fill most of two file boxes, and that's just since 1980. Protest and resistance at the Nevada test site goes back to at least August 1957, when a small group of Quakers were arrested at the remote outpost on the 12th anniversary of the bombing of Hiroshima. That night, they bore silent witness to the atmospheric test of yet another nuclear bomb, this time suspended from a balloon 1,500 feet above the desert. Their action helped build the movement leading to the 1963 Partial Test Ban Treaty that banned atmospheric testing. Thousands, including my wife Felice and I, have been arrested since then for trespass at or near the test site's main entrance just off Highway 95, about an hour north of Las Vegas. But on more than a dozen occasions in the late 1980s and early 1990s, as the movement for a comprehensive test ban neared success, small affinity groups also hiked cross-country into the vast desert reserve. They trekked with permission of the Western Shoshone, the indigenous stewards of the land who were evicted when the test site was established in the 1950s. Their intention? To block roads and disrupt operations inside the test site, and if possible, by their visible presence at Ground Zero, to halt each new test. A recruiting announcement in the March 1987 issue of the Nuclear Resister notes that these actions require stamina for several days of desert hiking with all gear and water. They also pose risk of injury due to ground movement at the moment of testing or radiation exposure in the rare case of an underground test that vents. In fact, at least one team would seek shelter beneath an overhang when the nuclear blast knocked boulders loose from the cliff above them. In the days before cell phones, these small teams relied on paper maps and citizens' band radios and walkie-talkies to communicate their location back to supporters in Las Vegas, who would in turn alert the media and publicly call on the test site to hold their fire. Responding to this increased infiltration, the test site added more remote sensors to the roads crisscrossing the range, brought in two more helicopters, and dispatched ground teams with night vision goggles. In 1986, the Department of Energy admitted for the first time that backcountry activists near Ground Zero had in fact caused the delay of a nuclear test codenamed Belmont. Four people had been caught crossing through the sprawling Nellis Air Force bombing range that wraps around three sides of the test site, but two others had slipped by, evading helicopters until the next morning when one woman got under the fence surrounding Ground Zero. She walked across the denuded desert, then crawled back under the fence and surrendered when security forces arrived. Her action companion was nabbed later that day when he came out into the open less than 30 yards from the perimeter. The Belmont test had to be delayed for 25 minutes, time for a helicopter to land and whisk him away. Once, two men hiked at night to a ridge overlooking a test site command post. They brought along a small tank of helium. At dawn, they filled heart-shaped balloons and sent them skyward in memory of the victims of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Later, test site workers picked them up as they walked along a road and drove them into the command post. Exiting the car, the men began leafleting and talking to the surprised workers until authorities arrived to arrest them. A conspiracy charge was dropped when the Las Vegas reporter who had interviewed them ahead of the action about their plan refused to testify. Many of the backcountry activists were jailed, and some served up to 3 months behind bars, including a group of six women who, in May 1987, had hiked 50 miles to reach Ground Zero. The test site protests, with thousands at the gate and scores in the backcountry, helped to turn the tide. The last underground U.S. nuclear test in Nevada was in 1992. By 1996, the U.S. had joined nearly every other nation in the world to agree on a comprehensive nuclear test ban treaty. Although Senate ratification of the treaty yet seems a distant hope, while some have called to resume the test program. This has been Jack Cohen-Joppa with more stories from the Nuclear Resistor Archives to inspire your activism today.
Activists, shout out.
Physicians for Social Responsibility, PSR, is launching a new training program for health professionals interested in learning about the health impacts of nuclear weapons and radiation. This 11-week online course will bring together leading experts, frontline community voices, and health advocates to explore the medical, environmental, and social consequences of nuclear weapons production, testing, and military use, plus health risks related to nuclear energy. Participants will also develop advocacy and communication skills to bring the health perspective into policy debates, media conversations, and community action. The program will begin on Monday, November 3, 2025, and run till February 2, 2026, on each Monday at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific Time, with some exceptions for the holidays. Registration fees for this 11-week course are accepted on a sliding scale, and participants are encouraged to contribute at the level they are able. They range from $400 for practicing health professionals down to a minimum of $25 to confirm registration. Scholarships will be granted upon request, and to receive a scholarship, contact them at nuclear@psr.org with the subject line Training Scholarship. We'll have links up both to the information about this training and for where you can go to apply for a scholarship. And put it on your calendar that the International Uranium Film Festival, the IUFF, returns to Window Rock, Navajo Nation in New Mexico on November 13 and 14. This is the fourth edition of the IUFF to be held in Window Rock and will take place in cooperation with the New Mexico Social Justice and Equity Institute and be held at the Navajo Nation Museum. I am intending to attend, given the support of you, the listeners, not just for the work, but hey, last Monday was my birthday. Don't send cake, but how about sending me to Navajo Nation? And we'll have a link up to the information page about what's going to be presented at nuclearhotseat.com under this episode, number 745. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, October 7, 2025. You know, you can get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email every week as soon as it posts, and it's easy to take care of. Sign up on your favorite podcast channel or, hey, cut to the chase and help us out. Go to nuclearhotseat.com and the yellow box, put in your first name and email address, and every week you will get just one email, I don't bug you, one email with a link and a short description of the show's content. That way, you will have no excuse for missing a single episode ever again. Now, here's a way for you to participate. If you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send that to us in an email at info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, thank you. Any amount helps us out, and we really appreciate your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2025, Libby Halevi and Nuclear Hot Seat. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, website, names of any guests whose comments you use, and me. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you that the Faustian bargain with nuclear is that you get electricity for a minute and radioactive waste forever. There you have it, your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat, what have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat, the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat, it's da bomb.